Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm joined today by Professor Cliona Caolig, who is the Clinical Lead of Inclusion Health at St. James's Hospital in Dublin. Cliona, thank you so much for joining us today on Reboot.
Thank you. It's always a big joy to get to talk to you. I always learn more from doing these than I give, so absolute pleasure. Well,
that's absolutely not true, Cliona. It's completely the other way around. But listen, it is lovely, lovely to have you on. And we're going to, obviously, we're, you know, in the midst of the raging pandemic right now. And it is, you know, such a difficult time, you know, for so many people. And, you know, I think, you know, in terms of not just the most marginalized in society, but also, you know, people who are in building sites who are going to be, you know, losing their jobs this weekend. We've got, you know, people who are, you know, hundreds of thousands of people on waiting lists, hospital waiting lists, knowing that they're going to be, you know, waiting longer, that we, you know, we've seen the, you know, the devastating mental health impact. We see the impact on education, that, you know, this is going to be a long societal, you know, shadow and scarring of COVID. And that while we're within this pandemic, we can see this. And that's something I want to talk to you about. But first, maybe the immediate crisis that we're in terms of the health system, you know, how is it coping? You know, we're talking about 1,000 people hospitalized today. We've got, you know, almost 100 in ICU. You know, that we're not at the peak at all in terms of hospitalizations. The wider, you know, obviously issues been put off in terms of treatment and that. What's your assessment, you know, at the front line of how are things going?
It's... In some ways, it's a sad place and a frustrating place to be. So my normal day job is I do have inclusion health, the clinical work with my absolutely amazing friends, teammates, and I do half-time research and teaching. And so I've been pulled back from that again, back onto a COVID ward as of yesterday. So, you know, back to where we were, back to having to drop things that we had re-put together in COVID-modified form over the summer and autumn. So, like, we have this really great weekly meeting. We used to meet down in Merchants Quay with loads of project workers, hostel managers, key workers, outreach, nurses, doctors, to talk about the people that we were all looking after, all worried about. Just a brilliant meeting. We got to make loads of new friends, really fun way to work. And that stopped in March. And we have put that back together now on Zoom. And then again, this week, I had to be like, sorry, lads, I'm not there again.
Explain the main focus of that work.
Oh, so that's my inclusion health work. Right. So, Jesus, you're never going to get me to shut up. So
no, we'll try and do it.
We know that that people are socially excluded, and homelessness, it's a manifestation. It's a like symptom of social exclusion rather than anything else. It's not random who becomes homeless. It's a really profound way to exclude somebody from society, from a meaningful kind of decent life, that they don't have a home. And we know that has amazingly strong effects on people's health. So we know that poverty is bad for people, but once you move into homelessness, once you're on that sharp edge of really pretty extreme poverty, it has really, really, really huge effects on people's health. And they get a lot of chronic diseases. They tend to have multiple things wrong at the same time. And it's usually coming on a background of very significant childhood trauma and addiction. So they really, when they interface with kind of mainstream health services, whether that's, you know, the hospital or whatever, and people aren't familiar, aren't used to working with people who've had those life experiences, it can be very rough on all sides, particularly on the side of the homeless person who is, or the person with addiction who's maybe, you know, can be unintentionally really stigmatized by the way that we run our services. Because they're really sick, they use a huge amount of hospital beds. So hospital is kind of like an ED is kind of like a beach, you know, and everything washes up there, the flotsam and the jetsam. And people whose needs aren't met, whether that's older people who can't access enough care in the community to manage to live in their own homes, or whatever it is, they come to ED and they get admitted into the acute hospital. That's how our health system works. That's how people access supports often. So about 10% of patients in James's in 2015 were homeless. which is a massive proportion of our patient burden. And often they were coming in. So acute hospitals are really good at, like, you know, you come in and you're bleeding from an ulcer in your stomach, or you have an awful pneumonia and you need antibiotics and oxygen. That's what we're kind of, that's how we're trained to think and how we are trained to think of what we do. And we're not always that good at taking, zooming back and saying, okay, right, this person has a pneumonia, but what are the things that led up to that? And what can we do now to try and reduce the chances that they'll be back here in another month or another 2 months? And so that really wasn't happening for the people who were homeless and had addiction. So with my friend Anne-Marie, who's a nurse with a lot of experience, we set up this inclusion health service, and we kind of made it up as we went along, pulling bits and pieces from all the other services that we thought were cool and would work, and really in partnership. So, like, it's weird. Sometimes in the hospital, you feel like people think that you leave the gates of the hospital and it's like, I don't know, in the Land of Oz, that you'll melt. But, like, we can still do things outside. So, you know, if I've a patient that I really need to see who I can't get into clinic, and they're in Sundial Hospital, which is closer to the front gate of James's than the back gate of James's is, like, I can go out and see them. And project workers and addiction workers and, you know, Simon Rough Sleepers team and all of that, they know those people that are really sick that we're working with. They know them really well. So we were friends. She now works on our team with a Canadian nurse called Jess Sears, who'd been working in Annalithi and in DePaul. And we were good friends with her. So she started bringing a few of her friends in to meet us once a week to talk about the patients, the people that we were all looking after. And then that evolved into this meeting that happens once a week, where we'd have 30 or 40 people turning up from all different services, just because we all got something out of it. We all learned a lot from each other. And also, I think, like, there was a really nice sense of, yeah, we're all on the same side dealing with the same issues. And it's very clear when you work with a group population like that to see what's missing. So, for example, there is a lot of homeless people in their 40s and 50s who need nursing home level care, who can't access it through traditional ways. So we were able to come up with a pathway for that. But you can very clearly see where the gaps are when you all get together. So we keep a gaps list, and then at least the smallest thing that we can do that's sometimes really important is to go, yeah, this piece is missing. Like, there isn't an answer for this. And then with that list that we all share, we can kind of, you know, collectively try in all our various channels to get those things to change. So it was the highlight of our week, that Wednesday lunchtime meeting. It was a merchant piece.
So now that really important work that was addressing those gaps has now been pulled back, and you're back now. What are you working on specifically at the moment then? Where are you?
So now I'm just, you know, I went in this morning and yesterday, and instead of going to see my homeless patients on the ward, I'm up on the COVID ward seeing COVID patients. And then I, you know, I was still doing that work at the time that we have our Zoom version of or whatever service we use, Zoom
version. And how are things on the wards?
They are tough. It's not as bad as the first wave when I think it was so overwhelmingly new. Like, you literally would wake up and go, oh my God, I have no idea of how we are going to get through this. Like, it was like standing at the foot of the Himalayas, looking up and thinking, there is no way that we can reconfigure our services. We run out, like, it's always, you know, seat of the pants, stretching everything in a normal day in the health service, let alone a normal day in the winter in an acute hospital, and thinking, how are we going to do this? And then seeing, you know, like, people are pretty cool and resilient. And what I think has not been bad at all in the Irish response to this is that there's been a lot of, like, okay, hospital X, you know what you're doing for your patients and your service and your teams, go off and sort it. And that happened, and things changed, and we were able to do things, but it was scary. And, like, you know, people were scared to come to the ward. So when I was on the COVID wards in April and May, like, there wasn't a lot of doctors and nurses and, you know, other OTs and physios and stuff. Not like there would be on a normal ward where there's people coming and going. You kind of felt quite alone with it. So there isn't that same sense of fear this time on the part of the staff. And we know what we're dealing with. But the patients are really sick, you know. Like, it's pretty grim watching somebody who, you know, is in their 60s and was grand up till last week, who can't breathe. And they're on 60 litres of oxygen, which is a massive amount of oxygen. and you've given them all the medication that you know works, which is one thing, which, you know, does help, but is not a magic cure. And you're just hoping that they're going to turn a corner and you'll come in and see that they're doing better. And that's a hard thing to witness. You know, I think as a doctor and or as a nurse or whatever, you feel like you should be able to make people better. And a lot of this was we didn't have any tools and we just had to stand there and watch.
And that has
so
to be
I don't
extreme.
Want where the UK is with no beds and, you know, that they are talking about like they're doing it like in a war where you literally pick the people you can save quickly and sort them out. And, you know, the people who are really in trouble, you just leave them to die because you don't have resources. I really, really, really don't want personally or for anybody to be in that situation. So I hope that we get things under control.
And do you think we're far away from that?
Far away from what's in the UK?
Yeah.
No, like this virus, it's exponential growth, right? Which is really hard for humans to understand. Our brains don't work that way. But like once it's out of control, it's those rabbits breeding. You know, you had two rabbits and now you've got, I don't know, 963 rabbits.
Yeah.
It's any gap. So even if you've successfully blocked it, you know, 99 times and it gets through 1% of the time, that 1% can be enough to drive a really rapid expansion. I'm hopeful. I think, like, even looking at how many people are on the streets, I think people are taking this seriously. So hopefully we'll see the numbers get back under control. But we don't know yet.
Because, you know, that scenario that you're outlining, like the human, you know, cost of that, the, you know, the loss of lives, the, you know, damage to people's health that will happen over the coming weeks is, you know, is horrendous, and that it's possibly preventable still.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, like, and it's even more bitter knowing that the vaccine is around the corner. I don't know if you follow, she's really cool. Woman, she's called Trish Greenhalgh. She's a GP, academic GP in the UK. She's on Twitter. She's a really smart, really, really cool woman. Her mom died 2 days before she was due to get her COVID vaccine from COVID.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like,
it's just.
And each story, and I suppose with my other hat on, you know, with my kind of social determinants of health, inequality in health, like the impact of losing of a death, a premature death or a traumatic death, it really spills out within that person's family and their well-being and their community. And like with the people with addiction and HIV and homelessness that I work with, a lot of them die in their 30s and 40s and have small kids, you know, that are left behind. And then sometimes you hear this, you really often hear the story and people from people who are really struggling with addiction and life, that they lost particularly a mother. Yeah. At a very young age. And I see that so clearly, that effect of losing people prematurely. Very hard.
It's traumatizing.
In Ireland, we love sitting around the bed, you know, like we're actually really good at death, I think, normally. And I struggled with that. And I wasn't even the one dying or the family. I struggled seeing people die on their own.
Yeah. No, it is traumatizing for people, that early loss, that, you know,
absolutely.
Yeah. You know, losing someone prematurely, and particularly for children and parents. And, you know, it absolutely is. And in terms of, you know, practically, what do you think? Obviously, the vaccine. How do you think the vaccine rollout is going?
So is it perfect? No. Is it probably as good as we could do? I think so. And I think the HSE have been pretty conservative in the numbers that they're promising and keep outdoing that. So I actually think we're not doing too badly at all. And there was a lot of, like, you know, James has got vaccine and they were like, right, sort yourselves out, you know, do it in whatever order you feel is needed based on your own stats. And people stepped up to that. I'd love to see it getting out into the community more. It's hard because the current vaccine, about 1 in 100,000, which is a tiny number, but still, gets anaphylaxis. And there's all this cold storage stuff. So it's not the easiest vaccine to roll out into the community. But hopefully the one that got approved today, the Moderna vaccine, will be a bit easier to do. So I think we're not doing badly at all. And I haven't seen any vaccine hesitancy. Like, I literally see people almost elbowing each other out of the way to get in the queue. And this is including people who don't get their flu vaccine. So I saw online, like, loads of, I don't know, a third of nurses in Austria aren't going to get the vaccine, like crazy numbers. And I don't think, hopefully we're not going to be seeing that here, but who knows?
Yeah, no, I think that in terms of the, so far anyway, but obviously it's very small numbers, that those who are, you know, seem to be embracing and, as you say, getting the vaccine. In terms of what can be done over the coming weeks and months, what do you think? Like, what should government be doing? What should the health system be doing? What should people be doing to try and get this
under control?
Be
doing what they always should be doing, Rory, which is firstly thinking about who needs it most. And that's usually the people that are the poorest and the most left out and the hardest to reach. And then you need to get people from those communities in to work with you on how to do it. So be particularly, I was doing a Nulik Naman podcast yesterday, and we were talking about the travellers, the Minkra community, and they've been so badly affected by this, as they are by absolutely everything. It's unbelievable to think we have a group in society that are treated the way that they're treated. And I would, if I was the head of the HSE, I already think we should probably be getting Mincare women in on the boards of everything, because they're going to see things from an angle of the people who are left out in society. But definitely around vaccination, I'd be looking at those kind of things. Because otherwise you don't realise. So one of the things you need for a vaccine is a PPS number. And that's not out of any political thing. That's just how they record who has got the vaccine, how they count it. But, you know, who doesn't have a PPS number in Ireland? Are the people who don't have a PPS number? Yes, we need to have a solution for that. So it's all about just really intentionally thinking through who you've probably left out and trying not to do that, because they're the ones who need it the most.
And do you think we're at a place, like, how quickly will we be vaccinating our most vulnerable, do you think?
So, I mean, we're vaccinating our most vulnerable in terms of age now in nursing homes. That's already started. I was really proud of James's in that they prioritised contract security and cleaning staff as much as they prioritised everybody else. So they see patients, they go into the same pile as the head of ICU, because we know that, you know, that people who are poorer get sicker with COVID. Absolutely. It's not in question. Look at the woman who died in Vincent's. She was a care attendant. The man who died in James's, the staff member, was a contract cleaner. So there's a big link there.
Just explain that briefly, because it is, just before you go on, that is a very, very important point, that you said the people who are poor get sicker from COVID.
Yep. Absolutely. And it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. And like, that's what I do a lot of my research on, and it's kind of what I think is so interesting. I'd happily spend the rest of my life doing research on, and we don't really understand it. So if we know that, like, poverty kills people, and, you know, people who are poorer die younger, and it was, you know, a lot of the way that that's explained is it's around, I'm going to use the quotation marks, and if I could make a call for people never to use this term ever again, lifestyle factors, like, you know, smoking, drug use. But actually, those things don't, if you statistically correct for them, they only account for about a third of the difference in any health outcome. They don't account for the rest. And if you look in animal models, so animals, you know, don't smoke or drink. If you look in animal models, you can experimentally manipulate their social rank. And it changes what genes are being expressed and what proteins are being made and not made. And it affects your immune system. So in monkeys, for example, which we're not that distantly biologically related to, high-ranking monkeys have a really good antiviral immune response. You can measure their rank by how often their fleas are picked out by another monkey, which is pretty cool as well. And so they have this lovely, like, really good antiviral response, and they don't do it. Their immune system is otherwise switched off. It's nice and calm and controlled. And the lowest-ranking monkeys, they have an immune system that's switched on. So they have chronic inflammation, which we know causes heart disease, cancer, COPD, dementia. We know chronic inflammation is bad for people. And they also have an antiviral response that doesn't work. So I think, like, there's really clear evidence from loads of countries that people who are poorer are doing worse from COVID. They're more at risk of getting it, but when they get it, they are also much sicker. And that's definitely what we're seeing now. And it's just such a good example of why we need to start to understand this, and also why we need to act on what we know around social determinants of health. And if you look at the young men, there was loads of young Roma men who died from COVID, men in their 40s. We didn't see that many, like, you know, kind of healthy middle class men in their 40s dying. That really wasn't something that we saw. And if you look at the, you know, who died, they tended to be people in lower paid, insecure employment. who are you know, it's we're not sure what part of the psychosocial thing is causing that effect on the immune system, but something is.
And how, in terms of obviously the structures of society, that, you know, the way, you know, the multiple inequalities that exist, from housing to, you know, general, you know, pay, as you say, you know, wages, conditions, you know, trauma and how people are supported and all those access to health, you know, affects us. But is there things that we could be doing now, do you think, to address that?
Yes. So I think what the little that we know is not surprisingly shows that early childhood is a really important time. And there is work from the US looking at, if you support parents of kids in low-income communities, those kids, their kind of biology is better 7 years later. So I think we need to really think about, you know, homelessness in children is unforgivable on so many levels, but like, it is a really, 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 really stupid thing to do. So, you know, like, can we just build enough houses to house people? It would be one. And putting those extra supports in with parents. So my life experience, like most of the people I know, no matter how crappy their lives are and how hard a time they have themselves, they still want to be good parents. And life can get in the way. But if we could, you know, support young people leaving care, for example, so that when they have kids, which they often might do at a relatively young age, that they're in a position, they have housing, they have employment, they have, you know, psychological support that we all need. I think that's probably the first thing that I would look at doing. Because it affects in so many ways, right? So, you know, those early childhood stresses and whatever, they're affecting people's immune systems and their biology and their aging. And they're also affecting their behaviors. And, you know, some kids are coming out with behaviors that make it harder for them to get, for example, the healthcare that they need, and through no fault of their own. Does that make sense?
Yes, no, it absolutely does. And, you know, it's something that Professor Wilkinson, you know, has talked about a lot in terms of, you know, the impact of stress and, you know, on you know, people, and, you know, that health impact of stress. And of course, when you're in poverty, when you're in precarious work, when you're in situations of poor housing, substandard housing, you know, it all causes massive stress.
And not just like any type of stress. There's some particular types of stress that are toxic. So one is not having any control over your life, which you don't have, if you can't get a job, if you don't have enough money. It's that like complete hopelessness of you have no agency in your own life. Mm. I think that's really, really, really toxic for people, for their biology. And the other thing I think is a lot around shame. You know, we can intentionally or unintentionally really shame people for being poor or having a hard time or having addiction or whatever, having mental health illness.
We do stigmatize them all the time. They're, you know, welfare cheats cheat us all.
Don't get me started.
You know, that they are absolutely shamed and stigmatized every day, and the way the welfare system doctors the way.
Like, just stop shaming people for stuff that happens to them that you know, like, who sets out to be poor?
Yeah.
Who sets out to be a heroin addict? You know, like, Jesus, it's not a lifestyle choice. It's not around, will I, you know, wear this brand of yoga outfits? But I don't know how you change that. I suppose, again, kids are pretty cool. You know, like, kids don't shame each other in the same way. So if we could just try not to teach them how to shame people, that would be a good idea.
Well, I think it starts throughout society. You know, it starts with the structure. The reason I said that the welfare cheat us all is because that is a message that is sent into society culturally from political leaders as to, you know, why people are, you know, we've had, you know, the head of homelessness in Dublin talk about lifestyle choices of homeless people. We've had, you know, the leadership. I think leadership has a lot to blame with how that's stigmatizing the narrative. It's been at the core of, you know, neoliberal politics for decades. Has been blaming, you go back to Margaret Thatcher and blaming the lone parents for, you know, the decline of family values and, you know, that blaming and shaming. And of course, it's about, you know, it goes to immigrants as well. It's about, you know, also diverting people's anger and frustration.
Yeah. And you know, like there are the natural human responses to shame are things that generally tend not to be particularly healthy for that person or for their community. So, you know, like addiction, you know, trying to get off your face or out of your head on whatever your substance of choice is one way to manage shame. And being aggressive when you're, you know, asked for the seventh time to sit down and you're antsy because you smell bad and everybody's looking at you and you're hungry and you're frightened and you feel ashamed. And you know that, you know, maybe when you see the healthcare provider, you're going to be told, you know, it's your own fault for getting yourself into this situation. You know, it's such an unproductive emotion, shame, in all respects.
Yeah, and it is. And of course, you know, it's a wider question of as well, something we could talk about on another one, another podcast is, of course, how these, the affecting of the most vulnerable with that stress, and we can think of it in COVID, affects everybody in society. And this idea that more unequal, not idea, but the evidence is more unequal societies affect everybody in that society worse. And COVID is a very good example of that. And just on that, to finish up, the whole question of zero COVID and where are we going from? We're in the midst of now this third wave. You know, how do we avoid a fourth wave?
I don't think we are making the right decisions to avoid a fourth wave, Rory, apart from vaccination, which is probably not going to be in time for a fourth or a fifth wave. It's going to take a while. And that's the frustrating thing to witness. You know, like I think the things that we didn't do well that we need to do well if we want to get to near zero COVID, and we totally can do it, are around travel. We need to do, you know, put people in hotels and make them quarantine, because humans do not like quarantine. Humans will not quarantine if you leave them, you know, to do it of their own free will. They ain't going to do it. They're going to cut corners. So we need to seriously address that. And the other thing is about really bumping up our public health, you know, workforce, recognizing and valuing that work that they do and keeping us all safe all the time. Can I say one more thing about shame?
Yes, absolutely.
So it's a little bit, I also work in HIV and, you know, in my training worked in sexual health. It's a little bit like that, right? People are ashamed about having sex, which is a normal human behavior. And so they, you know, don't go to be tested for their HIV. And, you know, then we're like, well, just don't have sex, you know, the response in the 80s or whatever. And the shame and the toxicity of that from a public health point of view, from an individual human point of view, from a health systems point of view. And the huge progress that has been made in HIV care by going like, let's just get the shame out of this equation. It doesn't belong here. And I wish we could do something similar for poverty related shame, maybe.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really interesting analogy. And of course, again, just to bring it back, there's also shame around COVID. Do you know what I mean? The shame around people having it, where they get it. And, you know, that's part of course, the individualization of the responsibility, which of course, it's our individual responsibility.
Well, exactly. Realization of responsibility, which is, I think, probably one of the major roots of our ills.
And that brings back to the question of getting to near zero COVID strategy is about actually government taking responsibility and for where we are at.
Yeah.
And you said there, just in terms of the other, just to finally to get out a few of the last things, because we want what needs to be done to avoid that fourth wave. So you've said the restriction on travel, quarantine, post-travel.
Much, much better resourced, like proper tracing and testing. Like what we're doing is, we call it testing and tracing, but it's not really like what that properly is. And then enforcing isolation and quarantine of people who are close contacts or have COVID because they're wandering around. Usually because nobody thought about how are they going to get food. Or, you know, do they have, like, are they able? So it's that individual responsibility piece as well. You know, take the individual responsibility out of it and sort it on a state level.
Yeah. Cliona and Kialik, thank you for joining me on Reboot Republic today. It has been absolutely fantastic to have you. And I've learned quite a bit today, again, from you. And we'll hope to do so in the future. We'll talk to you again, maybe over the next couple of weeks as things develop.
Absolutely. And have to get Niamh and Connor, who have taught me everything I just told you, to talk so that you can actually hear it from the horse's mouths.
No, that's great. Listen, Cliona, thanks so much for joining us today on Reboot Republic. And a reminder, as always, to listeners that you can go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, become a patron, support us to keep putting out these podcasts. Please, we are independent media, putting out the frontline workers, the voices of change, the ideas that we need to bring about a republic of equality and wider world. So please become a patron, become a supporter, and thank you very much for listening.